This is In the News for April 14th, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin from KSOWLP, Cottage Grove, Oregon. First story today is from Interpress Service at ipsnews.net, written by Mayuga Nduru, and it's on the health in Africa, an opportunity to change the course of history. This is out of Johannesburg, South Africa, dated April 12th. According to the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, 3.2 million of the 5 million new infections estimated to have occurred last year were in sub-Saharan Africa. More than 60% of all HIV-positive persons, just under 26 million, live in this region, even though it accounts for about 10% of the global population. The Year of Accelerating Access to HIV Prevention was inaugurated simultaneously in Johannesburg, Addis Ababa, Ouagadougou, and Khartoum, and is being spearheaded by the African Union and UN agencies. The hope is that countries in Africa will intensify and improve efforts to prevent HIV infection. In a statement by the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, distributed at the start of the campaign, quote, "It is unconscionable that every single day nearly 2,000 infants are infected with HIV during pregnancy, childbirth, or breastfeeding, most of them in sub-Saharan Africa, and that every single day some 6,000 young people between the ages of 14 and 24 contract the virus," end quote. It continues, quote, "This year presents an opportunity to change the course of the virus and of history," end quote. Those at the Johannesburg launch included South African Health Minister Mantu Shalambala, Ms. Mangweng, and Beninese singer Angelique Kidjo, attending in her capacity as a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador. Shalaba Misimbang told the gathering, quote, "We have to identify the drivers of the spread of HIV infection in the region and make concerted efforts to address them. These factors include poverty, underdevelopment, and gender inequalities that make women more vulnerable to HIV infection and the impact of AIDS," end quote. UNAIDS puts South Africa's adult HIV prevalence rate at 21.5%. The country has adopted the ABC strategy to stem the spread of HIV. This approach focuses on abstinence until marriage, being faithful to one partner, and condom use to prevent transmission of HIV during sex, especially where multiple partners are involved. Shabalala Misameng also said, quote, "Building on the massive condom distribution program, which is averaging at more than 300 million per year, our message will focus primarily on the correct and consistent use of these commodities that government makes available free of charge." The country has been accused of mounting a slow response to the pandemic. Activists remain concerned that President Thabo Mbeki and the health minister are not showing sufficient leadership in the fight against HIV and have called for the pace of antiretroviral provision to be speeded up. Southern Africa is part of the continent most affected by HIV. UN figures indicate that more than a third of all people infected with the virus at the end of last year were in this region, about 15 million. Governments and support groups in South Africa are seeking ways to curb the spread of HIV, sometimes confronting age-old customs. I apologize to any and all people who understand the languages of Africa better than I do for, I'm sure, mispronouncing several of those names, but hopefully the gist of the story still came through. Next up, from Knight Ritter and taken from commondreams.org, Iran's AIDS prevention program among world's most progressive. This is by Hannah Alam, and out of Tehran, Iran. It took 30 meetings just to create a slim AIDS awareness handbook for Iran's conservative high schools. A drawing of a condom disappeared early on. A photo of a syringe survived. A mention of sexual transmission was approved, but only with a reminder that sex before marriage is forbidden. Even after the government's wordsmiths were satisfied, AIDS workers in Tehran had to take the book south to the holy city of Qom, the spiritual center of Iran's all-powerful clergy. To everyone's surprise, the clerics endorsed it. Iran's fight against the spread of HIV hinges on a delicate give-and-take between activists who talk frankly about sex and drugs and the ruling Ayatollahs who fiercely protect the Islamic Republic's Puritan image. The combination has made Iran the Middle East leader in preventing HIV and AIDS. The country's program, which melds deep-rooted religious values with cutting-edge research, is being exported to Afghanistan, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Sudan, Pakistan, and other Muslim nations. Dr. Arash Elahi, one of Iran's most respected AIDS researchers, said, quote, "I told my colleagues in the United Arab Emirates, you're not more rigid than us. We're the only country in the world where it's the law to wear a headscarf, where it's a pure Islamic government, where you can't drink. If we have a prevention program, why don't you?" End quote. In a region where other Muslim governments ignore the epidemic, quarantine HIV-infected people, or preach abstinence as the only solution, Iran's approach is especially remarkable. It still doles out floggings to Iranians caught with alcohol, but it gives clean syringes and methadone treatment to heroin addicts. Health workers pass out condoms to prostitutes. Government clinics in every region offer free HIV testing, counseling, and treatment. A state-backed magazine just began a monthly column that profiles HIV-positive Iranians, and last year, the Postal Service unveiled a stamp emblazoned with a red ribbon for AIDS awareness. This year, the government will devote an estimated $30 million to the program. One of Iran's most acclaimed advances comes from its notoriously secretive network of prisons, where hundreds of drug-addicted inmates sometimes share the same makeshift syringe to inject heroin smuggled in by guards or visiting relatives. In a startling acknowledgment of sex and drugs, even in its most closely guarded quarters, the Tehran administration has made condoms and needles available in detention centers across the country. Dr. Hamid Setayesh, the coordinator for the UN AIDS office in Tehran, said, quote, "Iran now has one of the best prison programs for HIV in not just the region, but in the world. They're passing out condoms and syringes in prisons. This is unbelievable. In the whole world, there aren't more than six or seven countries doing that," end quote. Again, this is taken from Knight Ritter. It actually comes from commondreams.org, and you can find more on this issue. This is a much longer article than I have read. Again, it's written by Hannah Alam of Knight Ritter. And finally, today, on a somber but somewhat uplifting note, truly, an article also from commondreams.org, written by Robert Shetterly, and it's concerning the death of William Sloan Coffin. It's titled Journal 41306, William Sloan Coffin. These are the words, again, of Robert Shetterly. "I loved Bill Coffin. He died yesterday. It seems that he was the midwife to every important moral decision I ever made. He could never have known that, but I always consulted him in my heart when I had to risk something principled, starting with turning my draft card over to him at an anti-Vietnam War rally at Yale in 1968. He inspired moral courage. I had a long conversation with him the day before he died. A woman from Westport, Connecticut, had emailed me about having William Rivers Pitt and Stan Goff speak there on March 21st, and she wanted to know if I knew Paul Newman, who lives in Westport, to get him to introduce the speakers. I said I didn't, but I knew William Sloan Coffin, who is currently coaching Newman for the movie role as the preacher for Marilyn Robinson's novel, Gilead. Maybe he could make the connection. So I called Bill. The first thing he said was that he now had hospice care at home. The obvious subtext, the string was finally out. His voice was, as usual, buoyant, exuberant, but even more slurred than the slur caused by his stroke of several years ago. Medications, I thought. I could hear children playing in the background. His daughter Amy was there with her kids. His wife Randy, too. I thought of T.S. Eliot's quartets, children's voices among the leaves. The sweet sound that mixes mortality and hope. The quality in Bill's voice was not forced bravery in the face of death. He was exuberant. He knew he had lived nearly as good a life as he could have. He forgave himself his excesses and mistakes. He'd learned from them and lived long enough to redeem them through courageous action. If I had an aptitude for synesthesia, I'd see his voice in a rush of deep, rich greens, blues, and yellows. Or, to purposely mix metaphors, starting a conversation with Bill Coffin was like turning on a tap and having to jump back from the unexpected gush of water pressure, an immense, sparkling surge. He extolled hospice, but, even better, he said, was having a catheter, quote, you don't have to go to the bathroom comes to you, end quote. Sounds Shakespearean, Macbeth, isn't it? I asked for the Newman information. He called to Randy to bring him his address book. When he had it, he said, quote, half the people in here are dead, and half the pages are missing, and the parts don't coincide, end quote. He said he'd call me back tomorrow. But before hanging up, he wanted to talk about my portraits. When he had first seen the one I'd done of him, he'd had two problems, one of which he was tactful about, the other not. He was not tactful about the fact that I had accentuated his jowls. I lamely tried the excuse that the photograph of the portrait that he had seen made it look worse than the real portrait. I was a bit surprised at his touch of vanity, but I also suspected that he was pulling my leg, that in fact he was pretending to be vain. I wanted to say adamantly, Bill, this is about telling the truth. The next time I drove up from Maine to visit him in Vermont, I took the portrait with me. He conceded that the jowls were not so jowly. What could he say? What he was tactful about, but what really bothered him was the quote on his portrait, which I had taken from his new book, Credo. The quote was, quote, the war against Iraq is as disastrous as it is unnecessary, perhaps in terms of its wisdom, purpose, and motives, the worst war in American history. Our military men and women were not called to defend America, but rather to attack Iraq. They were not called to die for, but rather to kill for, their country. What more unpatriotic thing could we have asked of our sons and daughters, end quote. He seemed a bit unsure that he had really wanted to be that emphatic, and that my use of the quote exposed him in a way, but he left it there. I was surprised because it would never have occurred to me that he regretted the moral certainty of any utterance. I, of course, have been using the mask and shield of his moral power to give weight and protection to my own convictions. At this moment, I thought, in a funny way, I had less doubt about the rightness of his words than he did. But on the phone yesterday, he said, quote, you know, Rob, I had some concerns about that quote, but not anymore, end quote. When he said, but not anymore, his voice had, in spite of the slur, the characteristic booming roll propelled by sureness and good humor, giving one the sense that at the basis of every moral feeling, every right act, was a belly laugh boiling up like magma from the earth's core. I loved him for that. The seat of virtue for him was not set in stern righteousness, but in profound warmth, the smiling embrace of love. When I go out to talk myself, I love to quote Bill Coffin. He said, quote, if you lessen your anger at the structures of power, you lower your love for the victims of power, end quote. That says it all. It's what Terry Tempest Williams means by sacred rage. Whether it's a snail darter, a Blackburnian warbler, or an Iraqi child being made collateral damage for someone's unjust gain, the volatile mix of grief and anger and love fuels a holy flame. Bill Coffin, after son Alex had drowned, said to others and himself, quote, improve the quality of your suffering, end quote. Reach out. Use your suffering to heal other suffering. Don't solicit condolence. Use condolence to build a community of common experience, love and grief, hope and care. The beloved community. Bill spent his life trying to atone for having followed military orders in 1945, putting 3,000 white Russians who had fought against the Soviets on a train from Germany to Moscow and sheer execution at the hands of Stalin. He was 20 years old and had relegated his conscience to the subservience of following orders. He regretted that all his life. A little over a year ago, telling that story on the front porch of his house in Stratford, Vermont, he choked up. If there was such a thing as sin in Bill Coffin's theology, it was surely to not have used whatever power, moral or physical, one has to protect another's life from injustice. That's what drove him. A good drink, a good joke, a good song, a moral act, a worthy laugh. Again, this is written by Robert Shetterly, taken from commondreams.org, and concerning the death of William Sloan Coffin. And Robert Shetterly is a writer and artist who lives in Brooksville, Maine. He's author of Americans Who Tell the Truth. This has been In the News for April 14th, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin from KSOW LP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. I'll talk to you next time.